The theme of this evening is going to be the merchants of Tyre as seen today. Before we start, though, I would like to ask Brother Tim Colliver to come forward and to read for us Revelation 18. Thanks for that reading, Tim. And now I'd like to invite your attention to Matt as he speaks to the title tonight, The Merchants of Tyre as seen today.
Thank you, Matt, and good evening, everybody. Well, brethren and sisters, it's been 4 weeks since we had our last talk, and we've seen quite a number of changes happen in the world. We've gone from the risk of a hyperinflationary downturn to a deflationary downturn. One is where there's so much money sloshing around that it's not worth anything, so prices go up. The other is where there's not enough money going around, and so then, of course, the value of the money increases and prices come down. And our dollar has gone from being worth 96 American cents, or almost 1-to-1, to now hovering down to 60 to 65 cents, all in a matter of weeks. Now, brethren and sisters, currency markets move with the speed of glaciers. So for the US dollar to gain 40% over just about every single major currency in the world is unprecedented. It has never happened before. So normally for a currency to gain against everybody else, for the American dollar just goes skyrocketing in the air, you would expect to see a meteoric rise in economic strength in America. Are we seeing that? Well, no, we're not. America's economy is collapsing. So how is it that their dollar is going so strong? Well, how about the rest of the world? Is the rest of the world relative to America just fallen in a big heap? Well, we're all going down, but we haven't fallen that quickly. So how is it that this has taken place? Well, there's a headline there that basically says the economy struggles amid a credit freeze. Banks are reluctant to loan money, right? So there's easy money there. The interest rates in America are 1%. 1%. That'd be nice to have a 1% loan. But you can't get that money onto the streets. They refuse to loan the money. Okay, so even though there's cheap money, the money's actually not reaching street level. Okay, so remember the comment by Thomas Jefferson. We've had our boom period where easy money was flowing around. You go into the bank the same day, you remortgage your house and give your credit card attached to it, and all this money flying out the banks, right? And he said it was first inflation, get everybody in debt, then by deflation, everyone who's in debt struggles to pay that debt off, and the banks, of course, can reclaim their assets, or just claim your asset. So why has this fresh round of deflation, this credit crunch, taken place? Well, brethren and sisters, there's a lot of talk around in the media about all kinds of different things. But I think we need to think Tyrenian. This is where, ideologically, the difference between Babylon and Assyria and Tyre has been very, very helpful in understanding how the whole thing works. Remember back in July, Mr. Medvedev said that he wanted to make the ruble a reserve currency in Europe. Now, 40% of Europe's gas and oil come from Russia. They have to change their money into dollars and then go to Russia, buy their oil and gas in dollars, and then get their oil and gas. And he's saying, we don't want to do this anymore. It's a rubbish currency, right? We want you to get rid of your dollars and buy rubles instead. Now, that was an economic atom bomb from America. If Russia had forced that and Europe dumped their dollars and said, right, we're going to get euros, rubles instead, basically America would have been in a tailspin. Another Zimbabwe where wads of American dollars would have been needed to buy a glass of milk. Now, this is when it happened. When the dollar was 96 cents to the American, the Australian, so our dollar was almost level pegging and the dollar had lost its value. Now what happened in August? Well, suddenly the dollar started gaining value. It started skyrocketing. And of course all the papers are saying the same thing. Unprecedented dollar rise, not over yet, said Lehman Brothers. That was in August 26th, Bloomberg News. So it's skyrocketing because the banks restricted access to the dollars, okay? Now, what that means, brethren and sisters, and this is where Caesar's money comes into it, the fact that American dollar is king in the world. Everyone needs American dollars for international trade and for oil, something that's happened since World War II. Now, if you have all your debts to other countries in dollars, which you would, and you need to roll those debts over, so you need to get a bank loan to fund your debt and pay off your creditors, You go to an American bank and say, look, I need money. And they say, sorry, no money. He said, but this is 1% interest. What risk have you got? Sorry, no money. So what are you forced to do? You're forced to sell off commodities, assets, shares. And so everything has been going down in relation to the dollar. Oil, gold, commodities, shares, stocks, everything has been sold off in order to raise money so the Greece, the liquidity, the money that keeps the world turning can keep there. Because they can't get money out of America. There's cheap money's not hitting the streets. So money is scarce. And so 1% interest, but the banks won't lend, equals oil down, shares down, and commodities down. So if you're a country that depends upon oil price for your budget, now you're in serious trouble. Because your oil's only fetching $55, whereas before it was $150. Now, who is one of the worst hit economies out of this contraction? Who would you say? One of the worst hit. They're bleeding the hardest. We're all bleeding, but they're bleeding the hardest. That's right, brothers and sisters, Russia. Russia's sovereign default, its government may default on its debts. Because Russia needs $75 a barrel of oil just to balance their books, and it's down to $55. Right? So Russia starts saying, we don't want the US dollar. So Tyre kicks back and goes slap, 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 and now Russia's in a very, very bad way. And it does it in typical Tyre style. Everyone bleeds. When you conduct a price war between two companies, one's going to emerge victorious, but both of them hurt while the war's being fought. We have just seen that over the past 4 weeks. The Americans' dominance was questioned, and Tyre fought back. Right? That's basically what has been happening. Now, this is the advantage of having a universal currency. That's what Rome enjoyed by having the denarius as the currency of the empire. We said they learnt that off the merchants of Tyre. Now, you're not going to read this in the mainstream media. You have to piece a lot of different things together in order to do that. Chinese media and Russian media are very helpful because they hate what America's doing. And they actually report things very honestly as to what's going on. But not much in American media is said about how and why and what this happens. Okay, so this is where we need to read our Bibles. And this is an economic sign of the times, brethren and sisters. And this is how we need to be looking at these events. These are the keys that our Tyre studies have given us. We can look at events, we can look at the ideological biases of the different power centres of Babylon, Assyria and Tyre, and we can look at the anticipated prophetic outcomes, what we think are going to happen from here, what the Bible tells us the final scene is going to look like. So this is incredible. There's a war waging as we speak. And no one gets this kind of view, brethren and sisters. We have grandstand seats. The Bible is illuminated. It's opened our eyes, cleared away all the bluff, and we can see this for what it actually is. Right? But be warned, brethren and sisters, because America has a $12 trillion debt. Now, if the value of your dollar goes up, so does the value of your debt. And they can't sustain this. Eventually, the money taps are going to be turned back on again. And cheap money will once again wash over the starving, craving millions of the world. And as you would expect, brethren and sisters, when timed with stimulus packets, we were all going to get money for our kids. Wonderful. I've never been so happy I've had children. I'm going to get all this money from the government. In Lismore, they're going to get thousands, because they've all got eight kids. Right? But the money taps will be turned on, and we're going to have all this money, and they're going to have a boom. And already Rudd and Turnbull have said, oh, we think that the end is nigh, and we've just passed the worst. And so, of course, everyone's going to be talking it up. It's good. Confidence is up. Retail's up. Confidence, consumers, people are buying houses again. Isn't it wonderful? But brethren and sisters, the mess that got us here in the first place, excessive levels of debt, is not going to get better with more debt, even no matter how cheap. And so give it 3-4 months, and then the whole thing will peter out, and we'll be back to where we were again. Okay? Now, who knows? Christ might return during this period. Eating, drinking, buying, selling, marrying, giving in marriage. Or maybe we might just have to go through a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years of really tough times before Europe emerges, and then Christ will come as Europe's rising. We don't know, brothers and sisters. Maybe they might have a few more rabbits they can pull out of the hat to sustain things and keep things going. We don't know, but we can see where it's all moving. Okay, so what I'm going to do is just briefly summarise where we've come, because it's been about almost 3 months since we started these 5 talks. Now, our first talk, the take-home message was that we labour for uncertain riches, right? Here's our American dollar. But it's not a natural phenomenon. Our money belongs to Caesar, or in our case, it's Ben and Glenn Stevens. They control the money's purchasing power. So the fact that we lock our money away for years, but then it's not worth as much and it won't buy as much, that's not natural. The fact that our money loses its purchasing power and our savings end up diluted is just one of the strings that Glenn and Ben have learnt from the merchants of Tyre. The Phoenicians were the first to perfect this. And then we looked at the three great power centres of the kingdom of men. That's Assyria, there's Babylon, and there's Tyre. That's the representatives in the modern day. We all know about Assyria and Babylon as Christadelphians. We've studied it a lot, but we have not as a community spent much time thinking about the economic power centre of Tyre. And in our third talk, we looked at the trading centre of Tyre, didn't we? Its organisation, its complexity, and their use of collaborating and subcontracting work out to different countries and different regions. Things that are just as popular in today's Tyre-dominated world, where a plane might be made from parts from Japan and Australia and Germany and Italy, and they put it all together in America. Right? Tyre did that with their boats. Ezekiel chapter 27 tells us all about it. We looked at the oligarchical power structure of Tyre. We've got this king who set the standard. Remember, the first thing said of him in Ezekiel 38:28 is, you seal up the sum. So with a system of weights and measures that they used in their system of buying things, the person who set the weights and therefore the value of the commodities, because you weighed them all in a balance and worked out what was what, the one that set the weights for all of those merchants was the king of Tyre. Now we know they had a standardized system because when Abraham bought his grave from the cave of Machpelah, it says that he weighed the silver using weights standard amongst the merchants of the day. So there was a standardized weight that every single merchant used. The king of Tyre set that standard. In other words, he was the one that set the interest rates for the ancient world. The modern equivalent, the ancient equivalent of Mr. Ben Bernanke in America today. He was the man who was elected by the wealthiest families of Tyre who made up the power elite. And we looked at the prince of Tyre, a different power structure, but it would appear that the king of Tyre was in charge of land-based trade, the prince of Tyre was in charge of maritime trade, and Tyre dominated both of those things. And this godlike power that this prince of Tyre had, where his heart lifted up, he knew everything and said, you don't have any secrets that are held from you. You know everything that's going on in your trading network. You're at the top of the money pyramid, right? And this power caused his heart to be lifted up by God. By himself, actually, not by God. And in our fourth talk, we looked at the relationship that Tyre had with Israel during the reign of David and Solomon. A unique relationship, one that is a type of the kingdom age. We know this because the building of the temple was done by Tyrenian builders. It was subcontracted by Solomon out to Tyre. And Hiram, king of Tyre, part Jew, part Tyrenian, was the man in charge of this. And we saw the expansion of Israel and Tyre as a joint trading entity down into the Red Sea, which Israel gave them access to their Red Sea ports, as far as India and possibly even as far as China. The Jews and Tyre traded together. Okay, and so we saw that this unique Jewish flavour that Tyre takes on. So wherever Tyre is in the world, wherever Tyre has been, England, New York today, Jews have been prominent, Jews have been dominant. There's the sum of the companies that we looked at that are Jewish-owned companies that are dominating the business world today. There is your online king of Tyre, young people. Google is king. There's some other examples, and there's some other, all major companies. Remember the sons of Lamech? One was commerce, one was technology, and one was entertainment. Well, the Jews have got just about every single one of those industries all sewn up. Okay? And lastly, we looked at the brief role, that the unique role that Tyre has in the history of the world, of playing this idea, and this is what Ezekiel 28 says, of the guardian cherubim, this guardian role over the Jews for the last 2,000 years. And the pattern is very similar, isn't it, brethren and sisters, to that of Daniel and to that of Joseph. God put those men in second-in-command positions so that they could then use their influence to protect their people. Tyre has performed that role by being a safe haven for the Jews. So wherever Tyre has been, the wealthiest Jews are always very close to the throne or the power centre or politics or the banks, and they use their influence to provide protection to the Jews that are living there, which in turn attracts more Jews. So the United States today veto every single UN resolution that is against Israel. Always have done so. That's why, because they're modern Tyre. And we saw this attitude in England, in their attitude to the Jews, and when it played the role of Tyre in Brother Thomas's day. And today we see it, as we said, in the America, since the end of World War II, where they have taken the mantle of Tyre. We also saw that one of the key characteristics of the judgments of Tyre is that when they turn on the Jews, or they betray the Jews, as Amos 1 verse 7 says, they betray the covenant of brotherhood, that's when Tyre moves from one location to another. That's when judgments comes on one location and they move to another. Generally, because the richest Jews up with their money and move off to greener pastures. So tonight is our last talk on Tyre, and we have lots and lots of things that we could look into, but we are going to cull a whole heap of information, and we're going to cut to the chase, brethren and sisters, and try and follow the essential threads down to today and draw everything together. So briefly, what we're going to do is look at what we've just read, Revelation 18, and how that relates to Tyre and where we anticipate Tyre to be, and that is Europe. We're going to look very briefly at the relationship between Tyre and Tarshish, and then we're going to have a little skit over modern day banking, because if you haven't worked out by now, brethren and sisters, the king of Tyre is a banker. At the top of the money pyramid is the banks, right? In an economic market economy, which is what we all are, central banking is effectively king. And if you could go over all the media, do a little homework study if you want, go over every single newspaper article, you will never find politicians questioning the decisions of banks. It never happens. And as Napoleon said, the hand that gives is above the hand that takes. Right? So the king of Tyre today is no doubt a banker. Alright? So then we're going to look at the collapse of the US economy, and we're going to speculate how things could unfold. It will only be speculation, brethren and sisters, because there are a lot of twists and turns that could happen in the end result, and that is America down and Europe up. We are then going to consider briefly the emergence of a duopoly trading organisation, two trading blocks representing two dominant currencies, Tyre in Europe representing the euro, and the merchants of Tarshish representing maybe the pound or another currency. There's talk of an Amero emerging in Northern American continent. Competing with each other, these king of the north and the king of the south, for dominance. Something which we know another factor will bring the world to Armageddon. So this king of the north and the king of the south trading blocks. But before we go into all of that, and just in case we run out of time and I have to speed things up a gear or two, we're going to cut to the chase and prove what we've been intimating and hinting and just saying all along. What we are seeing in the world today, brethren and sisters, with all this economic upheaval, is part of the final migration of one location of Tyre across to another location of Tyre. America is going down, make no mistake about that. The patterns are remarkably similar to every other empire that's ever imploded and blown up. And it's going to migrate across to its final resting place before Jesus Christ returns, and that's going to be in Europe. Okay, so I've actually got a number of slides. I don't like doing this because I prefer to flick chapter to chapter to chapter, but we don't have time. So a brother did a study on this, and he did a very excellent summary, and I'm just going to flick through them rather quickly. It might be a good idea to get a pen and paper, write down the references, because you will see that when Revelation is talking about the judgments of Catholic Europe, the economic judgments you read of today are taken straight, word for word, out of the judgments of Tyre. And so we know that Europe will be a religious power, it'll be an economic power, and it'll be a militant power. And just the same as the Roman Empire was back in the time of Christ. Alright, so pens and papers out, there's the first passage. The merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Thou art situated in the entry of the sea, which art a merchant of the people for many isles, right? So you can see where the spirit of revelation is taken from, and it's basically in Ezekiel 26 to 28. Revelation says, how much has she glorified herself and lived deliciously? Is it deliciously or is it delicately? Who knows? With thy wisdom and with thine understanding, says Ezekiel 28, thou hast gotten thee riches and saw gold and silver. By thy great wisdom and by thy traffic, thou hast increased thy riches, and thine heart is lifted up because of thy riches. Revelation 18, the kings of the earth have committed fornication and live deliciously with her, shall bewail her and lament her. Then all the princes of the earth shall come down from their thrones, and they shall sit upon the ground, and shall tremble at every movement, and be astonished at thee, and they shall take up a lamentation for thee. Revelation 18, when they see the smoke of her burning, 28 verse 18 of Ezekiel, therefore I will bring forth a fire from the midst of thee, it shall devour thee and bring thee to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all them that behold thee. This is talking about Europe, brethren and sisters, and the language is the language of the judgment of Tyre. Conclusion, Europe will be the economic power centre of the world when Christ returns. Revelation 18, there's a summary of all the precious metals and stones that are included. Basically, the exact replica found in Ezekiel chapter 26 to 28. Right? That's where the language comes from, brethren and sisters. This is an economic judgment of Europe. Revelation 18, the merchants of these things which were made rich by her shall stand afar off for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing. All the inhabitants of the isle shall be astonished at thee, and their kings shall be sore afraid, and they shall be troubled in their countenance. The merchants among the people shall hiss at thee. So the incredulity, when people go, whoa, Tyre is finished. That rich, wealthy place, how could it ever happen? Saying, alas, alas, that great city. Imagine all the women who want to go shopping and the European shopping centres all shut down. Alas, alas, what a terrible thing. every precious stone was thy covering, the sardis, the topaz and all the stones that covered them. They're the things that was clothed, all the precious stones and the pearls and the gold and the silver. Revelation 18, every shipmaster in the company of ships and sailors, as many as trade by the sea, stood afar off and cried. So you imagine all the businesses and all the organisations, all the companies, all the networks, all say, hey, where's the base gone? Where's the capital? Where's the headquarters? Where's Europe gone? This is terrible. We're going to lose a lot of money. And all that handle the oar, the mariners and the pilots, shall come down from their ships and they stand on the land and cause their verse to be heard against thee and shall cry bitterly. And in their wailing, they'll take up a lamentation. Look at the headlines, brethren and sisters. There's a lot of wailing and lamenting because American Tyre is going down. And cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, cast dust on their heads, they wallow in ashes. And they're sad because the money that they've been making so far out of this relationship is all coming to an end. Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down. And I'll make thee a terror, thou shalt be no more. Thou shalt be a terror. Thou shalt be a terror. Three verses that talk about the terror, the violence of the overthrow of Tyre. And the voice of harpers and musicians, said Revelation, shall no longer be heard. A big part of trading empires, brethren and sisters, and we looked at when we looked at our ideologies, is entertainment. Right? It's the entertainment industry thrives because it's all about getting people to part with their money. Whereas in Babylon and Assyria, entertainment's focused around the state and the religion. Okay, so all the entertainment comes to an end. And of course, that's the same as when Tyre was judged. Thy merchants were the great men of the earth. You did enrich kings with the multitude of your merchandise. Okay, so, brethren and sisters, sorry that's so brief. I'd love to take an evening doing that. But basically, that demonstrates what we've been saying all along. That the signs of the times we are seeing, and there are many twists and turns that could happen, but basically it's all going to end up with America slumping and Europe will rise up and replace America as the dominant trading power in the world. But it won't be as united as it was under America. America has basically exerted its dominance on the whole earth. It's been a monopoly. This is going to be a duopoly, and we're seeing the cracks emerge. Europeans are saying, we're not happy with you Americans because you've been exploiting us with your dollar. And the English and the Americans are sticking together like this, and the Europeans are talking to the Chinese and say, we want a new Bretton Woods agreement. That's Bretton Woods, the agreement in World War II, where America said, you'll use the dollar because we're the winners. And Europe's just saying, look, we don't want this agreement anymore. We want a different one. We want to dump the dollar. We want to have our own currency. We're not happy. So cracks are emerging already, brothers and sisters, and they'll only get wider until America goes down. They get together with all Commonwealth, European and Russian trading bloc, and then, of course, we all know what's going to happen. Now, what I'm going to do now is we looked last week at the judgments of Tyre, and when Tyre became anti-Semitic, it was judged, and Tyre migrated on its own two feet. So come with me briefly to Isaiah 23, and we're going to have a look at this unique relationship with Tyre and Tarshish, because the merchants of Tarshish are the ones that oppose the European Tyre. So there's another trading bloc, and that trading bloc, the Tarshish entity, has been with Tyre right from the beginning. It's one of those Genesis chapter 10 areas. Now, I would love to spend more time on this, but I just can't. So we're going to go through very quickly. So in Isaiah 23, when Tyre is threatened, verse 6 says, "Cross over to Tarshish, wail, O inhabitants of the coast. Is this your exultant city, whose origins was from days of old, whose feet carried her to settle far away?" Right? And then it says, "Who has purchased these?" All the things that Tyre did. "Cross over your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more restraint anymore." So the way Tyre was set up is that they had the primary trading base, and then they had a secondary trading base, right, which took the rap when the primary trading base got into trouble, right? So Tyre was the primary, where all trade was centred. Tarshish was the secondary trading base, the second in command, similar to the relationship that's existed between New York and London. London is a dominant financial centre, not as big as New York, though. It's possibly surpassed New York in the last 2 years, but that's the first time since World War II. So there's a Tyre-Tarshish relationship. Now, we don't have time to go into Tarshish, as we know it's a talk in itself. Suffice to say that we know that Tarshish was India, and there was a Tarshish in England. So Tarshish appears to represent the eastern and western expanses of Tyre's trading empire. Now, talk to Peter Schwarzkopf about this. He knows a lot about this sort of thing. I couldn't even find the information I needed, so I know it's out there somewhere on my hard drive. I just can't find it. But in Greece, the word Tarshish means sea. In Hebrew, it means the sea coast. In Phoenician, it either means a smelter or refinery, or it means a new city. Now, I like to think that it could be a combination of all of those ideas, because Tyre was a combination of many different cultures and languages. A new city on the coast, or a new port city, which is what Tyre was. It was a trading, and a maritime trade was a dominant part of their thing. So whenever a new port city was established, there was a new Tarshish. And so the locals, whoever lived in that area, basically modified the word to their own vernacular, and the word or idea in many cases has persisted down to today. So don't pick me up on spelling. There is a brilliant document out there by a university student who's traced this. There's Tarsus in Asia Minor, Tarshishi in China, I don't know if that's right, one in Crete, there's one in Tunisia. The Septuagint translate the Bible words for Tarshish as Carthage. And there's a Tartessus in Spain. So as you can see, brethren and sisters, there is a Western migration. There's Asia Minor, there's Cyprus, there's Crete, there's Carthage, and there's Spain. Okay? So I tend to think that each time they pushed their borders to the east and the west and established a new frontier town, a new port city, they called it Tarshish. Not very original, but that's what they did. So when Babylon come down, the nobles of Tyre, we know, went to Cyprus. That's what Isaiah 23 is telling us, the crossover to Cyprus. And you notice there in the verse, where is it? Right, I've lost my place. So they went to Cyprus, but then the secondary judgment of Alexander the Great, they actually went across to Carthage, which is where I believe the Septuagint gets that across. Now, notice this verse here in Isaiah 23, verse 10. It says, "Cross over your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish." Now, I'm reading from the New King James Version. "Cross over your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more restraint anymore." Now, Rotherham translates this, "Overflow your banks like the Nile, Tarshish. there is no more restraint. Now, what that's saying is Tarshish as a secondary trading port was always taxed and always subservient to Tyre. So what happened when the old Tyre was taken away? Well, all the nobles run off to the secondary trading base, and the secondary trading base became the primary. Tarshish effectively became Tyre, if you like, and then Tarshish became strong. So you've got this idea of being kept in, like a river being kept in by the dominant party, but when the dominant party is taken away, it overflows and spreads out and becomes a new trading centre. So the Carthaginian Empire under Hannibal over here was probably the most militant and powerful of all the Phoenician empires. They possibly went and talked to Peter again. As far as America, there's an Indian tribe that, you know, they found Phoenician artifacts in them, right? And Hannibal, he was the man that marched elephants over the Italian Alps to attack Rome. He was the feared commander of Carthage. And Roman mothers used to say to their children, if you don't go to bed and go to sleep, Hannibal's going to get you. And they go, oh no, we'll go to sleep. And that's how it was. Okay, so the likeness is very similar, brethren and sisters, to the transition from England to the United States. England was the Tyre in Brother Thomas's day, and the United States was the secondary base, Tarshish, and Brother Thomas correctly identified India as the eastern Tarshish. England's empire was as strong as their military, but the world has never seen an empire like the United States. So while England was strong and the US was subservient, but when England was taken out of the way, America becomes stronger than what England was. Now, when the United States become Tyre, I believe that England, in effect, become a Tarshish. It was still the secondary base, it was still a partner, but it was the Tarshish in the east, and it would appear to be that the Tarshish in the west, the second most powerful economy in the world, could well be Japan. Me and Peter are still speculating about all this. But it's interesting, because we're not given firm guidelines. So it's wide open to speculation. Now, I anticipate, brothers and sisters, that when Tyre migrates away from America, carrying herself on her own two feet, England will be secondary to Europe. They'll rise up, but they'll be secondary to Europe. So they'll be, in effect, a Tarshish power to the EU. Which is why we can safely say in Ezekiel 38, the merchants of Tarshish trading block of nations that is in opposition to the EU, and that's Tyre, will oppose the invasion of Israel. And we in Australia are going to be part of that southern King of the South trading block. So Isaiah tells us that Tyre is a migrating power who carries herself on her feet to sojourn in her Tarshish location when she's threatened. In fact, if you look at the migration of Tyre over the last 2,000 years, they've been in every single western location that used to be inhabited by the ancient Tyrenians. Okay, now we're going to basically look, brethren and sisters, at the history of money. Now, this is a massive topic in the Bible. It's biblically, it's huge. Like, did you know, we all think God hates usury. God did hate usury, but he allowed the Jews to loan the usury to the other nations. In fact, he promised it as a blessing in Deuteronomy 28. You just weren't allowed to charge interest to your neighbours. So God almost encouraged the Jews to become bankers, which is probably why they're so good at it now. But we're just going to briefly look at the history of money. Now, my charade people get ready, not just yet, but we'll be almost ready to have a little charade. Okay, now money originally started off naturally as food, right? You grow lots of sweet corn, he grows lots of strawberries. You get sick and tired of sweet corns, you want some strawberries. So you say, well, I'll give you 3 sweet corns, you give me 10 strawberries. And you come to a deal according to what you value those things at. So it's not surprising that money, the shekel, which was the standardised weight of the ancient world, was equated at 180 grains of barley. Okay? So that was the first standardised weight. It was a shekel. I think that's a shekel there. And you used to weigh that in one side, and you would expect to put 180 grains of barley in, and the whole thing would measure up. Alright, so there was a system of weights and measures, whereby a merchant would say, well, do you agree that this weight's legit? Yes, I agree. Right, stick your barley in there, and weigh yourself 3, 4, 5 shekels of grain. And so that's how money started. It was a trade system, a barter system, and the weight system allowed everybody to agree on the basis upon which they would part with their hard-earned goods. Now, gradually, it got apparent that, you know, gold and silver then emerged as you know, commodities. They've always been there in the Bible as commodities. There's a brother out here. I don't think he's here. Is Uncle Bruce here? No, he's not. He is a John Kimes man, which is a brand of economist, and he called gold a worthless relic, but it's not, brothers and sisters, because gold is God's money. God guarantees the value of gold. You know how? Because God likened gold to one of the rarest commodities ever, and that's tried faith. And if God knew that in his eternal word, some point in history, gold will become as common as plastic, it's like saying, your faith is like tried plastic. Well, thank you, but that doesn't mean much. Right? So gold, God put it in the ground, God made it rare, God guarantees its value. Okay? So gold as a currency will more than likely feature in the kingdom age. You notice that I surreptitiously put that into my lecture on the New World Order of Jesus Christ. That's so I didn't have to say it tonight. So we won't go there. But trade will happen in the kingdom because they're going to be mortals. They're going to want to eat. They're going to want to trade and exchange and barter. So there will be a monetary system. There will be a system of economics in the kingdom. It will be much, much better than what we've got now. But we won't go there. Anyway, people got sick and tired of carrying these scales around. So they said, right, why don't we get this weight and we'll just stamp it into a coin. And say, right, everybody, that's a shekel. Do you agree? And everyone goes, all the people said, amen. Right, so the Greeks were the first. The Lydians come out with this idea of a coinage, standardising the weight. So eventually people thought, oh, do we trust the Lydians? They're a bunch of shonks. I'm going to bring my scales along. But eventually everyone thought, oh, well, yeah, they're doing the right thing. And that's a coin. And so what basically happened is the coin became a symbol, a visual symbol for a standardised weight. And it was also used for propaganda, where the emperor could stick his face on there and say, oh, I'm the king of the earth and all the rest. But the point with a monetary system is where you had scales and you could see your value, coins become a perception of value. You perceived that that was accurate and there was trust involved with those who minted it that they weren't cooking the books. And of course, that's what they wanted. They wanted people to just glance and say, yes, I understand that that is that value, and not have to keep weighing it all the time. Because what they could do is they could skim the silver off and make it a little bit smaller, therefore printing more money. Or they could stick a lump of lead in there and print off silver and lead, which weighed approximately the same. And so they could get more out of the money by minting it as a standardised weight than the system before, where you actually had a weights and a measures and everybody judged the value accordingly. Okay, and so what happens is those who took the valuable metal out and replaced it with lead, they would have more money, they'd go into the markets, they'd buy up all this stuff, and then the merchants are thinking, well, hang on, where did he come from with all that money? And he's bought out all our stock, we're going to have to raise prices now, but what's this money worth? And they'd melt it down and discover there was lead in there. And so they'd go, look, the emperor's devalued the coin. The emperor's devalued the coin. And it would slowly filter down, and everybody would raise their prices accordingly. But it took time. And so you have a system with a coinage where perception and true value compete with one another. And those who control the money use deception to try to mask their rotting of the system, effectively. Do you understand where I'm coming from? So the emperor basically melts down the money. He adds a bit of lead in there. He stamps more coins. He gives them to his nobles. The nobles go on a spending spree. People in the market think to themselves, hang on, all these goods are being bought up by all this money, something suspicious. They check the value, they find there's lead, and they up all their prices, but the whole thing filters down and then they pass the word. So the emperor issues more coins and he gets to buy everything at the old prices. But by the time you and I come along, who have worked our day for our little coin, everything in the price has gone up, everything in the market. And so they get the benefit of the old prices, but then we have to go along and pay for what they've done through higher prices. And that's what they call inflation, a hidden tax. Because what's the last thing to be adjusted for inflation? When all the prices go up, what's the last thing that gets adjusted up? Wages. Always is. Always will be. So the people and the corporations around the monetary system get the benefits, and the last thing to be adjusted is, of course, wages. So the emperor buys his goods at the old, cheaper prices. The market catches on. By the time we spend our money, all the prices have gone up, but our wages have not. But the underlying prerequisite of the old monetary system, brethren and sisters, was that there needed to be some value there to back up the perception. So someone had to go out and get gold and silver. Someone had to go and make a mine. Someone had to get purple. Something that had to get a store of value that everybody agreed on, gold and silver, and get it out the ground. So the emperor needed to have a constant source of gold and silver to make any money. Sure, he could play around with the value of that money, but if there was no base wealth in the coins, no one would actually use it. So you imagine for a minute, brethren and sisters, that you are the emperor. What is the perfect scenario for you at the top of the food chain? Well, the hardest job is getting this gold and silver in the first place, because people wanted this assurance of true value. What if you could just create the perception of true value? Or better still, you're the emperor, you've got an army, you've got a police force. Use legal power to enforce the perception of true value. So then basically you could make money out of worthless metal, and people would have no choice, they'd have to use it. Now how good would that be? No running around Africa looking for gold and silver, just get any old piece of junk, stamp it, call it money, and then use your army and your police to force people to use it as money. In effect, you have unlimited access to the goose that lays the golden egg, or the alchemy machine that converts lead to money, something that makes something useless valuable. Now that's the dream Rome tried to pull off, brethren and sisters, by removing all the silver from their coin. And brethren and sisters, it's exactly the same system that we are under today. This is a true definition of a fiat currency, paper money, legal tender. There is no value in our money outside of the value imposed by law. Our money is worthless paper. So let's fast forward 1500 years to England, before the Bank of England was established. Now, my charade men, I'll need you to come forward. Okay? Now, I'm Matthew Goldstein, and I'm a goldsmith. Okay? And there's my office, brethren and sisters. Okay? Now, basically, my job as a goldsmith is I buy the raw product, I refine it, I put it into bullion, and I sold it. Of course, I make a handsome profit on the way. But I also had the biggest house and the safest vaults. Everyone, if you want to store something and you don't want it stolen, Matthew Goldstein is the person to do it. And of course, all my friends are partners. And so say you had gold and you wanted to store it in a safe place. So you come along to the goldsmith with your gold and your silver.
Mr. Gold.
Thank you, sir. And I check it out. Yep, that's good silver. Oh, for goodness sakes. And I say, right, yep, okay, that looks like very smelly but otherwise valuable gold. Yep, that's good gold. Okay, fantastic. I'll store that in my vault, sir. Now, what the original banking system used to do is that it would charge him interest for storing his money in a safe place. So I'd give him my certificate, my receipt for gold, which has the photo of seal of authenticity and fidelity and trust, and off he would go. Right? And he would give me money for storing his gold. Right? So, basically, you come along and we need someone who needs a loan, because I've got lots of gold on reserve, and he wants a loan, so I say, righto, well, I've got some money for you, and, okay, fantastic, with my gold reserve, here's some gold, and I'll charge you interest. Okay? And so then he comes back again, he wants more loan. I think, okay, well, he's desperate. So I said, alright, well look, I do have, I've got that gold that Phil dropped off, that he's paying rent for. So they said, okay, Phil might not come back tomorrow for his gold, I'm just going to get it back off him. So I grabbed Phil's money that he's paying rent for. I said, alright, gold. Off you go, playing the traffic, you're going to get 7% interest. Phil comes back the next day, with his gold receipt, and he demands his gold. And hi there, Phil. Look, come back tomorrow, I'll make sure that I've got it. It's just under the piano somewhere, I can't find it. And so Phil thinks, hang on, he's loaning my money, he's charging me rent. So he says, look, if you don't want me to spread the word around and shut you down, you give me a cut of the interest that you're charging him for loaning out my gold. Alright? And that'll be happy. Okay, that's what we'll do. So I go to Phil with this gold receipt, he goes to the market, man. And he sees that he wants something,
to buy, but he hasn't got his gold, the gold's with me. And so he says to the market, would you accept this paper? All you have to do is go down to Matt Goldstein, the honest gold merchant, and he'll give you the gold. And so Mike said, yeah, all right, I'll do that. Now he may come to me and get his gold, but he may not. He may go to another merchant and say, hey, I've got this gold receipt. Go to the merchant down the road, he's got the gold in the bowl. Would you give me goods in exchange for that? Now I'm looking at all this and I'm thinking, man, people are using the paper and the gold in circulation to exchange for goods. So I start asking people who want loans, coming from another loan because you're desperate, would you like to have the real gold or would you like a paper receipt? So they accept the paper so you don't have to carry it around, right? Everyone's accepting it. And that people do it. Then along comes a guy who's really desperate, right? He's got no clothes, he's got a barrel around him, right? And he's hard up on his luck. And he wants 1,000,000 ounces of gold. I'm thinking, hey. So I say, right, sir, not a problem. So I go back and I just do not have 1,000,000 ounces of gold. Right? Now I've got a choice. I can either say, look, go to my Robert Goldstein, he's my cousin, he's a goldsmith, he'd have 1,000,000. Or I can say, look, would you accept the paper receipt or do you want the actual gold? And he says, I'll have paper. So I sit down and I write out a receipt for gold that I actually don't have. Touch wood that none of these guys want their gold back and redeem their receipt. So off he goes and I'm charging him interest on gold I don't even have in my bank box. Alright? So imagine what happens, that I'm making a huge amount of money charging interest on wealth that I actually don't have. So of course the banker got horribly rich. He had the biggest house. He was the most lavishly clothed person like me, right? So anyway, these guys have a look, and we've got all these receipts, and there seems to be a lot of them around, our prices are going up, why don't we go and get the gold? So they all come to me together, and I say, excuse me, we'd like our gold back, thank you very much. The game's up. I don't have the gold to match these receipts, so they burn me up, and they extort me. Right, and that's it. So I'm shut shop, I'm finished. So then I'm dead, and all my goldsmith buddies say, hey, you know, did you see what happened to that goldsmith? Crook that he was. We don't want that to happen to us. So let's get together and agree that we're not going to give out any more loans. So they didn't. No more loans. So you go to the goldsmith for a loan. Sorry, no loans. You go to start up a new business, can I have a loan? No, sorry, no loans. Well, what happened to the economy when the goldsmiths refused to give loans? Of course, it ground to a halt. So the government comes along to the goldsmiths and says, look, we need you to start lending money. The economy's growing, Germany's beating us, France is beating us, England's going down the hole. What do we need to do? So the goldsmiths say, right, here's what you want to do. We want to loan out more money than we actually have, and we want you to put it in law. And I said, but that's extortion. That's wrong. That's against the law. Sorry, no loans. So the government says, all right, well, you were greedy before. Matt Goldstein was a crook. What if we put a cap on you? You need to have 10% of real wealth and you can make 90% of loans. Is that fair? Yep, we're happy with that. That's good returns. And so, brethren and sisters, fractional reserve banking was passed into law, right? And you can look that up in the internet. There's a lot of papers on fractional reserve banking. It is legal just for banks. Banks can do this. Nobody else can actually do that. Now, brothers and sisters, when I went to buy that gold, I went to a gold jeweller in Adelaide and I said, look, do you have storage? And he goes, yeah, we got storage. I said, how much? Because everyone charges for storage. He goes, oh, free. And I'm thinking, free? How do you do that? He goes, it's all right, it's the service we provide. So I went to another goldsmith and I said, look, I said, these guys are charging nothing and you're charging me $5 a 6 months or something like that, whatever he was charging. He goes, yeah, you know what he's going to do with your lump of gold? He'll sell it 10 times and get money for just having a single lump of gold. So it happens today, brothers and sisters. Right? It happens today. But that's how modern banking started. And basically what happened is that the bankers got together and they worked together and things like that, and so eventually the where am I? I've completely lost my notes here. So anyway, by banding together, the goldsmiths discovered, brothers and sisters, that they could cause boom times by printing
more money, followed by depressions, you know, in sitting on their money. Now have a look at this, brothers and sisters. That is a American $20, and there is the original gold receipt for the US dollar, payable to the bearer on demand in gold coin. So our original money up until 1932 for the public, but 1971 for central banks, paper money was a gold receipt. There was supposed to be an actual ounce of gold somewhere in a bank that redeemed that whole receipt. Okay? So by banding together, the goldsmiths discovered they could control the economy by inflating and deflating the money. And using this power and the influence they had, they persuaded the governments to pass into law the right to loan out more money than they actually had. And what followed was a system of fractional reserve banking. And goldsmiths become the first modern banks. So by banding together within England, the first central bank was formed. So governments no longer controlled money. The banks issued money to society. Then along comes a family that shaped and moulded the modern global central banking system that we are all under today. And that family was the Rothschilds family. Now, this gentleman here, the original one, Mayer Arnschild Rothschild, it actually means red shield, which I think is interesting, the red protectors, if you like. He sent his five sons into the richest countries in Europe and gave them $20,000 each to set up their fame and their fortune. They went to Frankfurt, Naples, Paris, Prussia and London. Now, by coordinating their activities, the Rothschilds discovered that the same power the goldsmiths had over England could be exerted over the entire continent of Europe. You could create booms, you could create busts, you could play one economy off against each other using the money supply. And what they single-handedly put together was the central banking system, where private banks issue and control a nation's money independent, brethren and sisters, of the government, using fractional reserve banking to dramatically increase their wealth. All right, now here is an article here. That's not the article there. There's the Rothschilds. They were the tie that guarded Israel. And of course, this has been done, this latest disaster has been coordinated by central banks who are meeting overnight, putting these massive liquidity actions, loaning out money, doing all sorts of things to the global system. Now, the last country to fall under the central banking system, brethren and sisters, was the United States. And it's fascinating to look at the United States' battle with the banks. We just got stamped in the image and likeness of England. Here you are, here's a bank, here's a parliament, here's laws, boom, off you go. Right? America fought three wars over central banking. Our president, Andrew Jackson, Stonewall Jackson, he campaigned on Jackson and no banks. They tried two banking charters in America. And finally, in 1913, after a cycle of booms and busts, where everybody was in a real state of mess, which was caused by the banks, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was passed into law by Mr. Woodrow Wilson. Now, he in his memoirs, just before he died, said, "I'm a most unhappy man. I've unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is controlled by a system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated. The growth of the nation, therefore, and all our activities in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world. No longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men." That's what happens when a small group of private banks controls the money supply. Okay? Now what I'm going to do now is we're going to briefly have a look at a couple of videos that just prove this to you. Alright. Now this chap here, brethren and sisters, is he's an ex-governor or one of the members of the Federal Reserve Board. He now runs tours at the Reserve Bank of Chicago. Okay, so he's a man that's been in the system, he knows, and they managed to get an interview with him and has asked him a whole heap of questions before he refused to answer any more. But here's what he has to say about the way the whole thing works. And this is particularly talking about the creation of money out of nothing, where you actually get real goods in exchange for nothing. Now, we work for our money. They don't. They just make it, and then they go on a spending spree.
work. There are things, of course, we can't create money by fiat. Our checkbook doesn't have a ledger. So you write out the check, and it just was transmogrified right out of thin air, which is a nice checkbook to have. But as far as currency, M2, our money supply is $7,699,200,000,000, and only 11.5% of that is cash. But we have more cash in circulation than we've ever had in history because of the proliferation of ATMs and the insatiable foreign demand for our $100 bills. They don't use them as a medium of exchange overseas. They're using them as a store of value. Second, the U.S., Russia has more of our currency than any other nation. Then it's Argentina, then it's Korea, then it's Turkey. A lot of this is, I suspect, tax evasion. But at any rate, as long as they want it, they can have all they want. It costs us, the cost of production over at Treasury, $100 bill costs 7 cents. The new colored 100 will come out in September, that'd be more like 9 cents. But in the interim, American commerce and industry doesn't give them away. We're getting $100 worth of something, Belgian chocolate, French wine, something, for something that cost us 7 cents. It's not a bad markup. We call it seniorage. They can have all they want. Almost none of it ever comes back. It's virtually an interest-free source of revenue for Uncle Sam.
Yeah. They make it out of nothing, and they get $100 worth of goods. Is it any wonder that America is the largest economy in the world, dwarfing everybody else? That's the power of currency. Rome woke up to that and they copied it from the Phoenicians. The system where the goose that lays the golden egg. All right, now here, in relationship to the central bank being an independent organisation that the government cannot control, right, so they make decisions regarding money which overturn lives, companies, organisations, the government has zero power to do anything about it. Now here is the ex-Federal Reserve Chairman, Mr. Alan Greenspan. I won't say that. Forgive me. Come back here. Now, here is the Federal Reserve Chairman. Sorry about this. I couldn't get it in the other form. Now, he gets asked a question about the independence of the Fed. What relationship do you have with the government? And basically, he answers. Now, listen to what he says. It's incredible.
What is the proper relationship, what should be the proper relationship between a chairman of the Fed and a president of the United States?
Well, first of all, the Federal Reserve is an independent agency, and that means basically that there is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take. So long as that is in place and there is no evidence that the administration or the Congress or anybody else is requesting that we do things other than what we think is the appropriate thing, then what the relationships are don't frankly matter. And
we're an independent organization. Nothing that the President or Congress can do can influence our decisions. As long as they respect that, there is no problem. Right? So who is the power behind the throne? Who is the people that run the show in America? Mr. Rothschild says, I don't care what puppet sits on the throne of England, he who controls Britain's money supply controls Britain, and I control the money supply. Understandably so, by making public statements like that, he was a very popular man. But that is the way the Tyrannian system works. We are under that system. So all of us work twice as hard for half as much. They work half as much, they get three times the amount. It is a form of slavery, brethren and sisters. But it's better than Babylonian and Assyrian slavery, but it is a form of slavery. And when a disaster comes, we're left holding the baby. We're left paying the bills. Just like Ezekiel said, Nebuchadnezzar broke through the walls, he killed all these people, but there was no wealth. Why? The wealth was gone with the merchants. And that's what we're seeing. It's Joseph all over again, brethren and sisters. Suck up, the wealth concentrated in the hands of a few. There's Josiah Stamp. He was an ex-governor of the Bank of England. Banking was conceived in iniquity and born in sin. The bankers own the earth. Take it away from them, but leave them the power to create deposits, fractional reserve banking, and with a flick of the pen, they'll create enough deposits to buy it all back. However, take it away from them, and all the great fortunes like mine will disappear, and they ought to disappear. But this world will be a happier and better world to live in. But if you wish to remain slave to the bankers and pay the cost of your slavery, then let them continue to create deposits. And that's what he had to say. Now, he was the chairman of the Bank of England. Okay? So,
That is the way the system works, brethren and sisters, and that's why you can go through just about every single school of economics. You won't learn much about monetary policy. It's not in any school curriculums, because the whole point of the exercise is that we're not supposed to understand the way this thing works. It's a method of channeling money away from the many into the hands of the few. If you look at the American dollar, it's got the pyramid with the eye on the top. Right? The bottom of the pyramid is the marketplace. At the top of the pyramid is the money chain. That's Ezekiel 28, brethren and sisters. It says of the Prince of Tyre, no secret is hid from you. Right? You're the marketplace of the whole world. You know everything. No secret's hid from you. By your wisdom, intelligence, or wealth, you do all things. So he was the guy, the all-seeing eye at the top of the pyramid, and the marketplace was spread out underneath them. Now, brethren and sisters, what we're seeing in America is basically what happened in Joseph's day. A famine came, everyone was in desperate trouble, everyone cried out, save us, save us, and everyone ended up in the control of the pharaohs. America will end up basically owned and controlled by debt. Now, brethren and sisters, what's a consumer? We all heard this word, consumer sentiment. What ideas are conjured up in your mind by the word consumer? What animal would fit the idea of a consumer? A caterpillar? Through the leaves? A guinea pig? Someone said a pig once. It consumes an awful lot. Okay? Not noble ideas, are they, brethren and sisters? Now, once upon a time, we were customers. Right? And a merchant had to cooperate or operate within a code of ethics and honesty to earn our custom. Because we were customers and the customer was always right and we were treated with respect. Now we're locked into contracts, we're tied up with fine print, we're charged money if we leave a company for a better one. And this is what it is to be a consumer. The consumer sentiment's down, the pigs aren't happy, throw them more swill. That's the system we are under, brethren and sisters. That's what Napoleon said. The hand that gives is above the hand that takes. Now here is basically the idea that we ended with drat. Now remember our idea with Babylon, Assyria and Tyre. Now Putin represents Syria, right? We know that. Who would you say the representative of Assyria at the street level is? It's a soldier, brethren and sisters. That's the Assyrian system. It's a militant system. A soldier is a street-level representative of Assyria. We know the Pope, right? He's the head of another power pyramid. Who's his representative at the street level? Nuns and priests. Ben Bernanke represents Tyre. He has a monopoly on global trade. Who's his representative at the street level? The advertising industry, brethren and sisters. The salesman, the merchant who bows the knee and invites you into his shop. We know what gospel these people preach, and we know that the gospel this man preaches, Ben Bernanke, is materialism, consumerism, money, and the love of it. Money can buy you happiness. Money can get you what you want. This is about a religion. It's about faith in the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And what do these people use to manipulate us in order to get our money? Well, we know that sex sells, doesn't it, brethren and sisters? It's something that's preached through all the entertainment branches of the merchants of Tyre, the technology of Tyre, the political structure of Tyre, by blocking the influence of religion in government and schools. The religion of Tyre were the gods of Baal and Ashtaroth. Both were sensual and sex-crazed gods in the ancient world. Why did Tyre promote those kinds of gods, brethren and sisters, with such zeal? Jezebel had 400 prophets of Baal, salesmen of Baal. Nothing's changed, brethren and sisters, because it sells. We know it sells. And organized resistance, such as the Jews had, was the biggest barrier to the profits and monopolies that these people wanted. And organized religion had to be broken down. Nothing's changed. The same means and methods are used and preached and shoved down our necks with the same whole idea attached to materialism. Right? It's not the Babylonian way of doing things, brethren and sisters. And it's not how the Assyrians operated. But this method of marketing and immorality has always been the hallmark of Tyre, which is why God tells us the love of money is the root of all evil. And in this way, I feel that the gospel of Tyre has been far more spiritually dangerous than Babylon and Assyria put together to us Christadelphians. At least you know who the enemy is with Babylon and Assyria. Remember what Christ said in Matthew 10, don't fear those who can kill the body, but not kill the soul. Fear them that can destroy the soul and the body. We live in a world that's destroying our souls, brethren and sisters, by placating us with money and cheap indulgence. That's what Tyre is all about. And so, brethren and sisters, what do we anticipate is going to happen in the last days? Well, this is just speculation. But I believe that if Christ doesn't return very, very soon before the real crunch hits, we may have 1.5 to 3 years of hardship. It could be that Christ comes back at the end of these stimulus packets when they're just starting to peter out. Who knows? But we could have 1.5 to 3 years of hardship. I don't know how severe, but past migrations of Tyre indicate that it could be quite serious. The United States, we know, will shrink, perhaps to the size of France today. And out of the ruins of England and America, out of the ruins, England and Europe will emerge first. Now, I think China's middle class is going to disappear. China broke the rules of globalization, and that is they were supposed to be a slave nation, and they allowed a middle class. I think India is a much better candidate than China is because India has a caste system. If you're a dark Indian, you're never going to get out of the hole. If you're a light Indian, you go to Bollywood, right? So England has a cap on their middle class. They'll never get too big. They'll always have lots and lots of slaves to do dirt cheap labour. China messed things up. So China's middle class, I think, will disappear. Perhaps there'll be a new currency to replace the pound and rival the euro. We don't know. But the Jewish element of Tyre will be divided between England and Europe, which will initially be pro-Jewish. With America out of the way, Israel will have no choice, possibly, to offer peace to the Arabs. And the Arabs have already said they will respect Israel's right to exist if they go back to pre-1967. And possibly this big wall will come down, because that's what Ezekiel 38 says, without walls, nor bars, nor gates. But somewhere along the line, brethren and sisters, the church and Russia and Tyre will get together. Another side that these Jews down in the land, which will be allied to the Tarshish power, need to be taken out of the way in order to achieve their true objectives. And the nobles of Tyre, who I believe are Jewish, I think will turn on their brethren, as Amos 1 verse 7, and betray a covenant of brotherhood and sell their people into the hands of the Greeks, as Joel 3 says they will. Then Armageddon will happen and Christ will be in the earth to deliver the Jews and judge the nations. Babylon, as we know, is totally destroyed. Assyria, on the other hand, is converted. And Tyre is reformed. And we have for 1,000 years a reign where Tyre will once again be the center of global trade. And Isaiah 23, the last verse, says, it won't profit and hoard its goods, but it'll use its profits to feed people who come up to the temple to worship and give them clothes and food. Right? So are we ready, brethren and sisters, for what is about to happen? The world will melt down if Christ doesn't return and take us away. And it's going to hurt us all, brethren and sisters. It will hurt our families. People will lose their jobs. We need to have contingency plans. We need to know what we're going to do. Can we move back in with mum and dad, with grandma and granddad? Have a plan. Know what you're going to do. And just lock it in the back of your mind, just in case. That's what the ant did. But in many ways, it may not be a bad thing spiritually. When times are good, who needs an ecclesia? Who's out there spending too much money, having too much fun? Trials like this may teach us what is truly, truly important and cause us to pull together and unite in a way that perhaps we've never, ever united before. So we need to start working now, brethren and sisters, to ensure that we are prepared and that when we go through this period of hardship, we are united and we are supporting one another, because that's what the ecclesia, brethren and sisters, is all about. Thank you.